Right ahead.
May it please the Court, my name is Michael Kennedy. I'm the first assistant with the Federal Public Defender's Office in the District of Nevada, and I represent Robert Joseph Marshall. This case involves wiretaps, confrontation, and restriction on cross-examination. Starting with the wiretap, traditional investigative techniques were being used when the issuing judges on the Valu's first extension, second extension, and third extension were being told expressly that they were unavailable and that they were inadequate. Specifically, search warrants. We could not use a search warrant when, in truth and in fact, 3 months before, a search warrant had been used.
Not by the FBI.
By Metro.
Right.
And I focus, Your Honor, on the first, second, and third extension for two reasons. First, that was 95% to 98% of the actual tape evidence at trial from those wiretaps. And as the Carnero case shows, each wiretap standing on its own needs to pass the commands of the wiretap statute. Second, and very importantly, there was a meeting between the FBI affiant December 7th of 2000. Placed up here on the board, the first extension of the Valu's wiretap was December 18th of that year, after that meeting. The January 17th, 2001 extension was after that meeting, and the February 16th was after that meeting. The purpose of the meeting was that this character, Valu's, was caught double-dipping, the miracles of call waiting. He's on one line doing a huge ecstasy deal. He puts the guy on call waiting, and he starts talking to his handler from the Metro. So the FBI and Metro get together to discuss what was Valu's role as an informant. Rather than telling the issuing court, on the 18th of December, the 17th of January, and the 16th of February, the true facts that there had been a search warrant, what was told the issuing court was that it was a mere street encounter, which was a lie. There was no street encounter. Rather than telling the issuing court that Valu's had been debriefed, had been given a suspect, had been given an interview, had disclosed all the dealings, that was not told to the issuing court. Rather than tell the issuing court that controlled buys had been made from Valu's and Valu's associates, and seven Metro officers were there surveilling when that happened, that was hid from the issuing court. Rather than
And how much of that did the FBI know?
All of it after December 7th of 2000, Your Honor. I suggest that they knew it before that, but we don't even have to get to that question because, as I say, there was only one tape that was played at trial from the first two wiretaps and their extensions and the Valu's wiretap, the original wiretap. All of what I'm telling you was after the meeting with the FBI and Metro for the express purpose of discussing Richard Valu's. Even more importantly, the Metro had him on the hook. They had the goods on him. They found evidence of trafficking, guns, all sorts of items, and he had already given up two main suppliers. He had agreed to be an undercover agent, and he had done all these things. The traditional investigatory technique of just executing the search warrant, confronting him with the evidence, and having him spill his guts to 3 years of dealing worked. And the FBI knew that before they sought the 18th, January 17th, and the 16th. So what the true facts were are outlined at page 17 of the reply brief, page 14. This is just a representative, but there were six things that were the true facts that were omitted from these three affidavits. In addition, what was also said was, for instance, Valu's was apparently stopped and searched by Las Vegas Metro Police when they knew it was not a street encounter. All of this goes to the fact, Your Honor, that What ended up happening was, even with the wealth of all this evidence, there was no evidentiary hearing ever held on the wiretaps. Quite simply, the indictment and the evidence at trial was a fruit of these illegal wiretaps. This stuff was withheld from the court. In addition, the original Velue's affidavit, the one on November 17th, even though there was only one tape that came out of that, you have to at least explore under Ninth Circuit law, Ippolito being the case.
I want to make sure I understand the chart that you've got here. The statement at the top following each number is the statement that's found in the affidavit.
Yes, that are in quotes.
Okay.
So the quote is, Luz was apparently stopped and searched by the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police, when the true facts were that they had done numerous control buys, executed a search warrant, seized drugs and firearm evidence, completed the suspect interview, and he was on the hook to testify. Okay.
Down under number three, you have two things in quotes. The first is evidently from the affidavit.
Yes.
When he omitted that, what is that a quote from?
The second one is the affidavit, which says they did have irrefutable evidence, but they omitted to tell the court.
Wait, so what's that a quote from? Irrefutable?
The search warrant affidavits themselves.
The search warrant affidavit contains the words irrefutable independent evidence of Velue's involvement? You have an open quote and you don't have a closed quote.
That would be a quote from the second site, which is at 707 to 721.
Which is what?
Which is the search warrant affidavit that I went out and got within, after I received this on September
6th. That's from the LVPD? You have an open quote without a closed quote. I'm very confused as to what that means. You have a quote in front of irrefutable.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And no closed quote.
Yeah. It would be from the what I filed for the reviewing.
Okay, court. So that's not from the right. Government's
the
documents.
The first one is, I apologize.
Okay, so what the FBI was telling the district court on number three was that they had been contacted by LVPD, so they did disclose to the court that LVPD had contacted Velue's.
Actually, the FBI contacted Metro.
Okay, right. But they admitted that Velue's had been contacted by the LVPD, and this is what the FBI is telling the court.
Right.
So they're admitting to the court in the process of seeking these warrants
that they failed to have that irrefutable evidence when, in fact, they did.
Well, wait a minute. No, that they did. I'm still trying to understand your chart. I want to understand that the FBI is telling the district court that Velue's has been contacted by LVMPD.
Correct.
And they are telling him that he has apparently only partially disclosed his criminal activity.
And the affiant omitted that he had, quote, irrefutable independent evidence of Velue's involvement at the seizure from Velue, which they learned on December 7th. And having been confronted with that evidence, Velue had provided extensive evidence of his guilt and Gustaleo's guilt and that of other suppliers and those working for him.
Okay, now you gave me the quote again. Where's the closed quote on that?
It would be after Gustaleo.
Okay, and
that would come from CDE 707-721.
And that is what?
It is the motion that I filed to the reviewing court, which
that's your language.
Yes.
Okay.
Two exhibits that's based upon, the letter from the U.S. Attorney's Office first disclosing that to me, and the search warrant and Las Vegas Metro report that I was able to get between September 6th of 2002 and September 18th or 19th when I filed the motion. The wiretap evidence, then, is just simply illegal. There's no question about it. There's no question that it's material omissions that go to the heart of what an affiant is telling the issuing judge under the commands of the statute. It is intentional and reckless as to the first, second, and third extension because it's all after the meeting with Metro and the FBI to discuss what Velue's was doing, what had happened, how they had gotten to this point, and why he was double-dealing. For the Velue's original affidavit, if not intentional, it was reckless, because the initial Velue's affidavit said that it was long reputed that Velue's was a drug dealer. An initial baby step of any investigation would be to go to the local narcotics police officers and ask about information about this person. If that step had, simple step had been taken, they would have said, we've already done a search warrant. We've already got him. We've got his suppliers. He's working for us. He's doing these things. Everything that the original Velez affidavit told the issuing judge that they couldn't do, it was inadequate, they couldn't do it, was already being done, which makes it worse in kind than the Canaro case and the other cases.
All right, counsel, why don't we go through these one by one, and you tell me exactly what's wrong on number one. Number one, Velez was apparently stopped and searched by the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police. Now, what's false in that?
That never happened.
That Velez was not stopped and searched?
No.
Was he searched?
No. They executed a search warrant. They went inside his house. They uncovered all this. There was never a street encounter.
Do you object to the word stopped because it suggests that it was a street encounter?
Absolutely. It hid from the
court. They didn't say it was a street encounter. They just said stopped and searched.
No, they said that it was stopped and searched by the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police.
Right.
Correct. It's easy to say we executed a search warrant.
Okay.
When you say someone stopped and searched, it's conveying something that's different than the true facts.
Okay.
With respect to the second one, a search of Velez's residence would not likely result in sufficient evidence to prosecute Galeo or street-level dealers under Velez or Galeo.
Wrong.
A search had already gotten that information. Velez was on the hook, or he faced charges, and they already had that evidence.
And your argument is that the FBI knew what the Metro had already obtained.
Yes, because they met with him on December 7th for the express purpose of finding that out. Then they went on the 12th, the 17th, and the 16th, those next 3 months.
Okay, number
with
three.
The third one, that they had irrefutable evidence. Well, they had Velez's search. They had him confessing to 3 years of drug dealing. He'd given up Galeo. He had given up
right.
a different.
Did the FBI have any reason to believe that Velez had only given up partially disclosed his criminal activity?
None, because they met with Metro for the express purpose.
So if the FBI knew that Velez had given up everything on his criminal activity, that's pretty difficult to
and you can see it by looking at 707 to 721, because the search warrant and the police report tells you that. And that was the reason they met with him, to find out why he was on the phone hooking up a deal. I will address right quickly. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did you want to reserve some time?
I do. I want to reserve about 2 minutes. I'm going to briefly say that the confrontation clause is at issue here because Velez was never called to testify as a witness. I objected to that for the tapes coming in, and the Crawford case, which I submitted a 28J letter, addresses that. He was available, and Velez was acting as a government agent receiving evidence, so it was testimonial. It is just like the situation with Sylvia Crawford and Michael Crawford in Crawford v. Washington, and I'll address that further.
But in those cases, it did not involve the hearsay exception on proof of a conspiracy. And as I read the testimony, also the government offered this in terms of the context of the information rather than for the truth asserted, and that's what the district court found.
Your Honor, if that was the basis, then obviously it's not in for the truth of the matter asserted, but that raises the confrontation clause because the witness itself is unavailable, and obviously entrapment was the defense at trial, so they took from me, by their decision not to call Velez, any ability for me to cross-examine the voice who was heard the most on the tapes at trial. The primary source of information at trial was Mr. Velez, and he was putting that information together, working as an agent of the government, and I was unable to cross-examine him. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ms. Bliss, do you want this up or down?
Oh, it's just fine, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
Kathleen Bliss for the government. Your Honors, all of these arguments that were made, all of these assertions, were made before Judge George. And Judge George found and did not clearly err in finding that the defendant could not demonstrate that Metro was part of the federal investigation or vice versa. Judge George also found, and this is in the excerpts of a record beginning at page 744, are Judge George's specific findings in the arguments of counsel. But he also found that it was clear that Valluz was only reporting a very small portion of the drug activity he was involved in. The Metro officers, if you go to their testimony, the handler, which is Mr. Jones, as well as the undercover Metro officer, Mr. Hernandez, if you go to their testimony, they say the same thing. They didn't know how much drug activity Mr. Valluz was involved in.
The point that Mr. Kennedy makes is that it's kind of hard to argue that traditional law enforcement techniques have been unavailing when, in fact, they have.
But they weren't. And the reason why is because no one knew what Valluz was doing, as demonstrated by Mr. Valluz. No one could control this man. But the traditional methods and techniques that were used, FBI had begun its investigation using surveillance of Mr. Valluz. And if I may go to my notes real quickly, under the necessity portion, we had, the FBI had three CSs it had been using. The first was a DEA informant, so that informant wasn't controlled by the FBI. The second one had ceased communications with Rick, meaning Valluz, after the early months of 2000. Then you have CS3. This source was probably the most important source. And so beginning in January of 2000, you have this source involved with Mr. Valluz.
That's January 2000 or January 2001?
It would have been January of 2000.
Okay. Then that's prior to the affidavits that Mr. Kennedy is complaining of.
This is prior to the CCA 156, which is the Valluz affidavit. And what it's demonstrating is what FBI had done in an effort to exhaust, which isn't the standard, but what they had done in an effort to avail themselves of traditional investigative methods. So you have CS3, the most significant of the sources, beginning in January of 2000. And this is all outlaid in the CCA 156, that wiretap. January 2000, Valluz is dealing drugs. February 2000, Valluz is dealing drugs. Seven transactions are observed. There are seven phone calls in the apartment. There's also security cameras that are observed by CS3 within Mr. Valluz's apartment. In May, Mr. Valluz is dealing drugs, not at his house, but at a bar. He's supplying ecstasy. Then in June of 2000, you have two drugs within an hour at Valluz's apartment. July of 2000, you have another drug transaction at the apartment. In September of 2000, you have Mr. Valluz expressing to CS3 that he is concerned because there were newspaper articles that had come out talking about the ecstasy trade, and this is what CS3 was mainly witnessing, but the ecstasy trade in Las Vegas. So Valluz is starting to get very cagey at this point in time. In October of 2000, Valluz expresses to CS3 that he is wary of the police, and so Valluz starts making more drug transactions at the casino. In November of 2000, FBI Miami confirms that there is a significant drug trade for ecstasy in Las Vegas. Mr. Valluz is surveilled by FBI, again, preceding the 156 application, from April to May of 2000. Now, the affiant tells you that surveillance must cease when Valluz moves into a gated condominium community. Valluz also has become very circumspect, and that's corroborated by what CS3 says, and he's very difficult to trail. As far as necessity, there are pen registers.
When did Valluz start cooperating with Las Vegas PD?
Your Honor, Valluz started cooperating in August 11th of 2000, according to his handler, Mr. Jones. And there was a search warrant that was executed. Now, counsel makes.
When did the FBI ever debrief Valluz?
After
connection Metro? In connection with the wiretap affidavits?
In connection with 156, they.
Any of the wiretaps, any of their extensions?
Only, no, sir. They never – they were trying to wiretap Mr. Velez. And so there was no debriefing of him. There was
– and I may be confused as to the dates, and please clear them.
Sure. It's very confusing, Your Honor.
There came a point in time
– yes, sir.
Whatever their prior knowledge was, that the FBI became aware that Velez was cooperating with Las Vegas Police Department or purportedly cooperating. Correct?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
Was that before or after any of the affidavits were filed to seek wiretaps or extensions?
FBI became aware that Mr. Velez had been searched, and this is the apparent. There's nothing in the record that shows this statement was anything that FBI believed anything other than what the statement says. They weren't aware in the first application of CCA 156. And the extension, CCA 156X, you have a statement by the FBI stating that it's become apparent that Mr. Velez had what they thought was a street encounter with Metro. But, Your Honor, FBI agent Leon did not know about the connection between Metro and Velez. And that's at the excerpts of record 1159 to 1162. This is in their testimony before the court. McCain didn't know, and he had become the affiant on the extensions. And that's at excerpts of record 1392.
FBI ever asked to interview Velez?
To Metro, no. They had wiretapped him first. They didn't know about his involvement with Metro, Your Honor, at the time that they did the 156 application. They did not know. During the wiretapping that began November the 17th of 2000, that's the FBI's wiretap, that's when they learn through intercepted calls that he's having a contact with Metro. Then in December...
This is the call waiting thing that Mr. Kennedy referred to?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. They alert Metro that Mr. Velez is double-teaming, double-dipping, I think is the word that was used. But the wiretaps continue. And I want to correct something that counsel says as far as the full extent of Mr. Velez's drug transactions being revealed in the Metro search warrant, which I can't emphasize enough that FBI in its original application did not know about, or in the extensions. They did not, Metro testified, they did not know about Marshall or Crozier. It was limited to Mr. Gallo. They also, Metro officers also said they didn't realize the extent of what Mr. Velez was doing. And, Your Honors, even when FBI brings in Mr. Velez as a cooperator, and that occurs in 2001 on March the 10th. I mean, I'm sorry, on March the 8th of 2001, when they bring in Mr. Velez. Thereafter, Mr. Velez can't even be controlled by the FBI and was later arrested. That's also in the testimony. And that's what Judge George knew was going on. In fact, he said that Velez, his conduct throughout the course of dealing with either state law enforcement or federal, just reinforced the fact that traditional means of law enforcement investigation were not successful. Crawford does not apply, Your Honors. It deals with testimonial statements. At no point in time were Mr. Velez's statements introduced for the truth of the matter asserted. They were introduced as context. And this Court has approved.
What do you mean by that term? I'm somewhat vague about what context.
Your Honor, as I think as very well explained by the Seventh Circuit decision called Gajo, I think I'm pronouncing it G-A-G-A-J-O, it demonstrates the use of statements and puts them into context. What you're admitting for the truth of the matter asserted is either, in this case, going to be the admissions, which are clearly not hearsay, of Mr. Marshall, or the co-conspirator statements, which would be those of Jerry Brown. The court 10 times told the jury, you cannot use the statements of Mr. Belews for the truth of the matter asserted. But it put the tapes, it put these conversations into a context where the jury was focused on the statements that were coming in for their truth, which are also not hearsay. Co-conspirator statements are not hearsay. They're not subject to Crawford. And neither are a defendant's admissions. They're not hearsay. They're not subject to Crawford.
Was Belews available?
Yes. I have to say he would have been available. Certainly.
So this is not an unavailable witness by reason of medical condition or assertion of the Fifth Amendment or something like that. He was available.
As far as I understand the record, that's correct.
Everyone could have called him, put him on the stand, and said, is that your voice on these tapes, and allowed the defense to cross-examine, right?
That's correct.
Why isn't that a violation of the Sixth Amendment?
Because the statements didn't come in for their truth. And, Your Honor, if I could just refer you to that Seventh Circuit decision, it also cites that it's well established there, even though it's a 2002 decision, certainly following Crawford, it discusses the distinction. And those statements were not testimonial. And Crawford tells you what testimonial statements are. And in Crawford, those statements are going to include police interrogation by witnesses, statements that are sworn or unsworn by witnesses. These were all tape statements that came in through these tape conversations. And again, they were limited 10 times throughout this trial. The Ninth Circuit in the Whitman decision at 771 F. 2nd, 1348, which is cited in the Gageau opinion, is showing that it is well established, it's well settled, says the Seventh Circuit, that such approach in allowing these for context is appropriate because statements are not hearsay to the extent that they are offered for the context and not for the truth of the matter asserted. It's well-established case law, and Crawford, I submit to you, does not put that into question. Only if those statements had come in for their truth, yes, there would definitely be a confrontation issue, and Belews would have had to testify. The government would have had to call him.
Well, would that be true, even though it's evidence of a co-conspirator?
No, sir, because under Federal Rule of Evidence 801, it clearly excludes, expressly excludes, co-conspirator statements. So long as the conditions are met, excludes them as hearsay. And Crawford deals with hearsay. So just like a defendant's admissions, the admissions of Mr. Marshall, those come in under 801 as not hearsay evidence.
Was there an objection to that on the Confrontation Clause at trial?
Well, there certainly wasn't a Crawford objection because
Crawford didn't exist.
No, Crawford did not exist. I know that counsel objected repeatedly, except when the jury asked to hear those again, and then they didn't object, which we would submit would be examined under a plain error analysis. But I still don't think Crawford applies. And, Your Honors, I can submit a 28-J letter. I will tell you I anticipated or at least thought that Crawford could possibly apply. I looked at Crawford again, and I also pulled recent decisions. I think the Eighth Circuit has ruled on this since Crawford. But I saw Crawford as being an opposite, so I didn't file a 28-J letter. But there are numerous cases out there. There's nothing from the Ninth Circuit except a District of Hawaii case, I believe.
Crawford's Supreme Court.
Yes, sir. Since Crawford. There have been some lower cases, District Court, as well as, I believe, one Eighth Circuit.
Okay.
Thank you
for your argument, counsel. Rebuttal argument, Mr. Kennedy?
There was a written motion filed the minute that Velluz was not called to testify, arguing on the Confrontation Clause grounds. Second, Velluz was an informant when these tapes were going. He was not a co-conspirator. Under Sears, you can't co-conspire with the person who's working for the government. The government offered no tape under the co-conspirator exception. Third, it was December 7th at that meeting where the information was given about the wiretaps, and the extensions were that month, December 18th, January 17th, and February 16th. That was 95% of the trial evidence. Mr. Velluz, this was an entrapment case, and we cited at page 28, the government cited the Seventh Circuit case for this context-only principle. There is no Ninth Circuit case that permits context-only admission of evidence where the actual speaker is not there to cross-examine. We looked at the facts of every one of those out-of-circuit cases, and on page 28, the court said the declarant is there to be cross-examined. This was an entrapment case. The government has conceded to you that this man, Velluz, was no one could control him, and the government precluded me from showing that to the jury. He was debriefed by the FBI. The moment three wiretaps and four extensions, the moment this man was moving serious weight, kilos and kilos, 50, 100 kilos, the moment Bob Marshall came up, they shut down the wire. They served a search warrant, the FBI, in March on Velluz, what they said they couldn't do. They debriefed him. He cooperated again. Why was he on the hook to testify at trial? He was on the hook to cooperate with the government from August 11, 2000, because he was never prosecuted for that, and he had to agree to continue to work with them.
I think you're substantially over your time.
And he was available because he was under a written agreement with the government not to be prosecuted for his efforts after that with the feds, and they only prosecuted him when he dealt drugs a third time and was caught. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank both counsel for their arguments. The case just argued will be submitted for decision. We'll proceed to the next case on the calendar this morning, which is United States versus Mendez-Garcia. Counsel will come forward, please.